Hi, it's Dr. Sanjeev Goyal from Peak Human Labs, and today I have a very special guest with me, Dr. Sanjeev Chopra. Dr. Sanjeev Chopra is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and hepatologist. He's also been the former faculty dean of the continuing medical education at Harvard Medical School, where they reached out to over 80,000 clinicians in 150 countries. He is also the editor-in-chief of the hepatology section of UpToDate, an online resource that's used by more than 600,000 physicians worldwide for clinical decision-making at point of care. Dr. Chopra is also a best-selling author and motivational speaker sought throughout the world on leadership, purpose, and today we'll be talking about that and other topics, and I hope you enjoy today's talk. We'll see you on the other side.
Sanjeev, how are you?
I'm on top of the world. Sanjeev, how are you?
Good, good, good. Thank you so much for taking the time today to chat with me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, truly my honor. Delighted to be on the show.
So maybe just before we get started, do you mind just taking us through a little bit about your background? I did give a bit of an intro, but just, you know, where you've come to up to today, what you're doing these days, and then let's get right into it.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm a physician and I became a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School many, many years ago. And then I was appointed the faculty dean for continuing medical education at Harvard Med School. And when I got that appointment, I said to myself, this is an amazing leadership position and I need to learn about leadership. Mm-hmm. I actually told the head dean when he appointed me, I said, as a leader, I need both responsibility and authority. If I have authority but no responsibility, I'm a tyrant. And if I have responsibility and no authority, it's martyrdom, and I'm not ready for either. So I started devouring leadership books and going to leadership courses. And then my colleagues at Harvard Medical School, I was in charge of a conference called Current Clinical Issues in Primary Care Medicine around the country. Mm-hmm. In Boston, in Baltimore, in Anaheim, together with other academic institutions like Johns Hopkins and UCLA. And we had keynotes every morning. And I had previously given keynotes on primary liver cancer, historical perspective, contemporary management, future directions. And they said, Sanjeev, you should give a talk on leadership. And right. So I developed a talk. And I did something interesting. I invited five of my mentors and said, I've developed a talk and can I show it to you? And would you please critique it?
Right.
And they critiqued it and they gave me some interesting suggestions. But now I had the confidence that this was going to be a good talk. Then I wrote a book, Leadership by Example, The 10 Key Principles of All Great Leaders. 20 years ago, a very spiritual friend of mine, Adrian Wilkins, we're sitting having coffee, and he says, Sanjeev, you got this award, you got this one, you got that one, you did this, you wrote this book. I said, Adrian, stop. Where is this conversation going? You know all this. Why are you bringing it up? And he looked at me, and he said, what is your purpose in life? And I'd not reflected on it. This was about 20-plus years ago. So I sat on the deck. My wife had gone to New York to be with the kids and grandkids, and I wrote down my purpose in life. And everything I do now has to be aligned to my purpose. It doesn't matter how much fame or fortune, but if it's not aligned, it's a distraction or a detour. And I've given this talk now called Two Most Important Days, and I wrote a book, How to Find Your Purpose, Live a Happy and Healthy Life, with a friend and colleague, Gina Will. She was the associate dean of external communications at Harvard Med School. So we worked a lot together. And we're very dear family friends. So, you know, one thing leads to another. During COVID lockdown, because many, many keynotes were canceled, conferences were by Zoom, there was so much time. I can't sit idle. And I find it hard to believe myself, but in 16 months, I wrote 4 books. And 3 with colleagues, 1 on my own. 3 have been published, and the 4th one will be published in a couple of months. And this one is sort of interesting. If you're in the medical profession, one can be a clinician, researcher, CEO, author, speaker, innovator, public health. So chapters on all of these elements together with a junior colleague of mine, Dr. Pankaj Vij from California. And it's going to be called Letters to a Young Doctor. So you go in the medical profession and you can carve out for yourself an alternate or parallel career path like some of us have done.
So this book is coming out soon, the Letters to a Younger
It's
Doctor?
Coming out soon. I'm doing the finishing touches. It needs about 3 hours more of work. And then it'll initially come out as an ebook.
Okay.
So looking forward to it. I've dedicated it to Dr. Paul Farmer, who go down as the greatest humanitarian of our time, an amazing individual. He was in my medical school class and graduated in 1991. And I'm saying it sort of matter-of-factly, not to brag, but the graduating class in 1991 bestowed upon me the Excellence in Teaching Award for being their best teacher for 4 years. So I got to know Paul Farmer and Jim Kim. And I actually, they started Partners in Healthcare, and they provided the most seminal care for the poorest of the poor, the most destitute in Haiti, Rwanda, Peru, Russian prisons, Native American reservations. So I sent in the manuscript and I said, Paul, you're doing God's work and I hate to intrude, but if you have time, take a look, and if you like it, endorse it. Sanjeev, I'll get it back to you in 4 weeks. The most poetic endorsement. And then February 2022, on 21st of February, he sees patients all day in Rwanda, goes to sleep, and has a fatal heart attack. And he passed away at age 62. Oh. And I've decided to dedicate the book to him.
Okay.
And at least 50% of any royalty advances I get will go to Partners in Healthcare.
Okay. For, you know, the purpose part, let's take a step back. That sounds, that was your, that really became part of your own mission. Your own purpose in life was to help other people find their purpose. Is that correct? Is that?
That is absolutely correct.
So how
so
did,
you know what
yeah,
I,
go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that, why, how did you realize that people are living without purpose? Like, why
there's
did you?
Actually research, there's research to back this up. There's an article in Harvard Business Review some years ago.
Yeah.
Only 20% of CEOs of Fortune 500 companies have clearly defined the purpose of their company, and less than that have defined their own purpose in life. And so I came up with the idea that the happiest people on this planet have four things in common. And the first is they have a cadre of good friends. Your friends are your chosen family. Robert Louis Stevenson said, a friend is a gift you give to yourself. Khalil Gibran said, friendship is a sweet responsibility, never an opportunity. And the longest standing study that's now gone on for 85 years, what study goes on for 85 years, is called the Harvard Grand Study on Adult Development. And a year after Hitler's troops marched into Austria, 750 21-year-olds in Boston were recruited. 250 went to Harvard. 500 were from very poor and often dysfunctional families. Off they went to the war. They came back. They re-entered the study. Detailed questionnaires, then physical examination, EKG, cholesterol, CRP, functional MRI. A cohort of their children, 2,000, are being followed in a similar study. And who was that group? What happened to them? Some ran for the Senate. Some became doctors, lawyers, nurses, janitors, skid row alcoholic derelicts. Some died of suicide. One of them was our president, John F. Kennedy, was in that study.
Wow.
And the single conclusion of the study is that loneliness is toxic, and that your satisfaction with relationships with friends, and that could include your family, at age 50 is a better predictor of health, happiness, and longevity three decades later, at age 80, better than your cholesterol, your EKG, your blood pressure, your CRP. So that's number one, friends. Number two is the ability to forgive. Anyone listening, if you're holding bitterness or rancor in your heart against an ex, a friend, a colleague, a sibling, a neighbor, my plea, get rid of it. And the moment you make that decision, you'll feel this enormous weight come off your shoulders. Nelson Mandela spent 27 years in prison. When he's released, Mr. Mandela, do you harbor resentment against your white captors? He gave the most beautiful answer. He said, I have no bitterness, I have no resentment. Resentment is like drinking poison and then hoping it will kill your enemies. There was a famous scholar, theologian, author from Germany, Louis Desmarais. He said, "To forgive is to set a prisoner free and discover the prisoner was you." So number two is forgiveness. Number three is doing things for others. Albert Schweitzer, Nobel laureate, theologian, what a humble man. 1952, he gets a Nobel Peace Prize. And at the ceremony, he murmurs, "Now I have to go earn it." Talk about humility. And he once said, "I don't know what your destiny will be, but one thing I'm certain of, the ones amongst you who will be truly happy are those who have sought and found how to serve." So I've distilled it to three S: friends, forgiveness for others. But the fourth one begins with G. And it's interestingly, it's not God. You know it, it's gratitude. And Robert Emmons, the father of modern positive psychology, has written a wonderful paperback book published called Thanks: How the New Science of Gratitude Can Make You Happier. And he did a large study. He randomized people for 6 weeks, said at the end of the day, half of the group write down three random things you did, the other half write down three things you're grateful for. And the ones who expressed gratitude, their happiness quotient went through the roof. So friends, forgiveness for others, and gratitude. But happiness is more than the sum total of happy moments. And for you and me to have sustained happiness, we have to find our purpose and live it. And that's a wonderful quote by Mark Twain, who once said, "The two most important days in your life are the day you're born and the day you find out why." What's your purpose in life?
So the part about you said the purpose part is there's you said there's studies that show that people are lacking personal purpose. I know you said about CEOs, but how do
Even
we know
company
that people are lacking personal purpose?
they interrogated people and said, "What is your purpose in life?" And people said, "Oh, we haven't thought about it."
They haven't thought about. I would just, I
They
mean,
haven't
isn't it?
thought about it, right? They think about success and they think, "If I succeed, I'll be happy." But actually, Albert Schweitzer said the opposite. He said, "Success does not lead to happiness. Happiness leads to success." The ancient Greeks did use the word happiness. They used a term called eudaimonia, which literally translated means human flourishing. If we are happy and we find our purpose, we will flourish in life and we will radiate happiness to everyone around us.
Does the I mean, one would think, okay, that usually a purpose might be something like, okay, I'm going to help other people, or generally we have these kind of big statements. People think about these. Are you saying that people should come up with very granular type of statements like, okay, my purpose is to, solve hunger or something? Like, are you thinking that type of purposes or
I
what?
think it's different for different people. And I have a dear friend, and she and her husband and Mark Anthony, 12 years ago, opened an orphanage in La Romana, Dominican Republic. They now have 33 orphanages. And one is a home for children dying of cancer to get their last wish fulfilled. We become dear, dear family friends. I know the entire family. She's come and stayed with my wife and I. We've stayed at her home in La Romana. When I go to Chicago to speak, meet her. And 6 months into our friendship, she said, "Sanjeev, help me define my purpose. You talk about purpose." I said, "Elena, I've known you for 6 months. Write down something, send it to me. I'll reflect on it. And a week later, I'll send it to you." So she sends me a page.
You're
I
right.
read it. It hits me right away. I said, "Here's how I see your purpose. If you like it, keep it. If not, toss it out. I, Elena Sotomayor, have exuberant compassion and love, not only for my family and friends, but also those less fortunate and in dire need." She said, "Sanjeev, I got it. My mother read it. We were both crying. Thank you so much." I have another friend, beautiful friend, lives in a neighboring town. We often get together for dinner. I said, "Susie, what's your purpose?" She said, "My purpose is to be the best mother and grandmother for my children and grandchildren, to be a loyal friend, and to tend my garden." Simple purpose. And she's one of the happiest people on the planet. She has the most beautiful garden. So for different people, it can be different. For some people, it could be to change the world. There's a young lady by the name of Mariah Smith. When she was born, she was abandoned outside an orphanage. At 2 years, adopted by a family in Virginia. She goes with her mother at age 17 to a takeout. She's about to sit in the car with the food. She notices a man, it's winter, sitting on the curb, shivering. She says, "Mom, I'm going to give him the food." Her mother says, "Sure." They go home. She says, "We got to go back. I have to give him a clean blanket." So she gave him a blanket. She's known as the blanket girl. The merchants in the area support her. She goes at 11 o'clock to parks where there are these homeless people, often abandoned by their families, refusing to go into a shelter, in a big van. And she has these cardboard boxes that contain a blanket, water, insect repellent, nutrition bar, and she just doles it out. So she's known as the blanket girl. She has now given away 180,000 blankets and boxes. The merchants help her. Now chapters are opening up in other parts of America. And she was asked, "What was the reaction of that first person you gave the blanket to?" She said, "Oh my God." He looked up. His expression was a combination of shock and gratitude. "It haunts me to this day, but it keeps me going." So she found her purpose with that interaction. And I can tell you many, many, many stories like this.
So does it, okay, so I mean, I want people to go and get the book, but I wonder if a little bit of a nugget you could provide to somebody who's going to take that first step to what's the first thing they should do if they want to start to think about what is their purpose? Like, what should they do? How, what is the question they should ask themselves? I would be
One of the things I do in a workshop that I teach with my dear friend, colleague Adrian Wilkins, it's called Invitation to Happiness. It's about a day-long workshop. And we give everyone 33 by 5 cards. We also give them a gratitude journal with their name on it. And say every week on Sunday, as you're reflecting on what's in store for you next week, look back at what transpired last 7 days and write down what you're grateful for. But the 33 by 5 cards, at the end of the day, write down three or four or five things you did that day. Okay, and then give it a rating where one, you were miserable. If you were lucky, 10, you were in bliss. You were joyous if it was 9, very happy if it was 8, like that. At the end of a month, line them up, all 30 cards, and strike out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Look at 6, 7, 8, 9. That gave you happiness, joy, bliss. You know what? Your purpose is lurking in there. Simple, low tech.
Yeah, for sure. I guess it's where we are. We are where we spend our time, and where we spend our attention is where that's what we
Yeah,
do.
that which you put your attention on grows stronger in your lives. And one of the keys is to have friends who will inspire you, who have the same core values. James Rohn, a best-selling author, once said, "You are the average of the five people you spend the most time with." You're the average of the five people you spend the most time with. So if we are into drink, your friends who would like to drink and gamble, we'll sort of gravitate and become like that. Choose
So
your friends carefully.
how do you make, so once you have, let's say you had, I don't know how many years ago when you first defined your purpose, has it changed, and how often do you come back to it and look at it again? Does it still match?
So I'll tell you what my purpose in life is, which is in the book. And my purpose in life is to fulfill my dharma. As you know, dharma is a Sanskrit word which incorporates vocation, moral compass, authenticity, and truth. My purpose in life is to fulfill my dharma, to teach medicine, to teach about leadership, to teach about happiness, to do it grounded in humility and with an ardent desire to learn every single day, to celebrate with gratitude my family, my friends, my colleagues, my patients, and my students who inspire me in countless ways and in some small measure inspire everyone I meet on this amazing life journey. It's a little long, but I wanted all those elements in it. And I keep that in my awareness all the time. And anytime I get an offer, I got an offer from a dear friend based in Canada to join a board. And he said, "We've picked three people from Canada, including a living Nobel laureate. Be honored if you would join the board." I said, "What's the purpose of your organization?" He said, "Oh." Then he sent it to me, and I said, "I'm sorry, this doesn't res this is not aligned to my purpose. I cannot join. I hope you will understand and forgive me. He said, he changed the purpose. And I'm on his board now.
Wow, that's so interesting. That is so interesting. I mean, yeah, I feel like it must have taken you some time to get those words. I can see all those words all have some meaning. I mean, for a person out there, it looks like, yeah, it takes some time and effort to think about these words because they
But
all
they'll come
have,
to you. They'll
yeah.
come to you. And sometimes they come to you when you witness something horrific and you say, you know what? I'm going to make a dent here. I have a dear friend. I met him at a leadership course at the Kellogg School of Management some 20 years ago. He's from the country Colombia. His name is Jaime Aramillo. He's now about 70 years of age. At age 20, he's standing in Bogota at a street corner. And across the street, there's a sewer. And in the sewer live these orphans with human excrement. And he's saying to himself, I should help these kids. A 7-year-old beautiful girl emerges and they're smiling. And now he's even more convinced he has to help these kids. And as they're having this interchange, a car comes around the corner, stops in the middle of the street, window rolls down, somebody tosses a toy, yellow school bus, Fisher-Price toy. The car recedes. This girl has never possessed a toy. She comes running up to the middle of the street, picks up the toy, and she's beaming with joy looking at Jaime Aramillo. And as they're having this interchange, a speeding truck comes around the corner and smashes her into oblivion.
Oh my
And he
God.
says, this is my calling in life. Sanjeev, he has adopted, homeschooled, and fed 100,000 orphans. So he's a national hero. His name is Papa Jaime. I said, Papa, how do you pay for it? He said, Sanjeev, I have a bakery. The only thing we make is cookies. And I've convinced all the restaurants in Medellin, Bogota, to have a cookie jar next to the cash register. People, as they're leaving, grab cookies. There's a shoebox with a slit. They drop change. Sometimes a dollar. I get 50% of my needs that way. I said, what about the other 50%? He said, I'm a motivational speaker. I speak all over Latin America and plow my radium into my foundation. I said, come on, that doesn't cut it. He said, you're right. Every time I need money, out of the blue, somebody helps me. Says 3 weeks ago, I needed $41,000 to pay my bills. So I go to three banks to get more loans. They turn me down. Papa, we love the work you do. You got loans with us. Don't even tell anyone what rate, but we can't give you more loans. So he's coming back to the office, and there's a street woman across the street. She crosses the street, gives him a hug. Papa Jaime. He says, are you hungry? Come to the office. So she's sitting in the office. Office drinking coffee and eating cookies. He's on the phone calling three other bankers, and she can tell that he's being turned down. So she looks at him, smiles, says, Papa, how much money do you need? He said, Sanjeev, I told her I need 41 US thousand US dollars. She looks at him, smiles, and says, I give it to you. He said, Sanjeev, I said to myself, she's cuckoo. She's a street woman. She opened her purse, she had $60,000. Her son had sent her the money. To move into a house, she had to go to a bank, deposit it. She says, I've saved some other money. The weather's good. I can move later. You need it now. Your children need it now. No questions asked. Take it. You can return it when you want, if you want. That kind of thing happens to him all the time. His kids have grown up to become computer scientists, the junior national champion of tennis from the country of Colombia some years ago, one of his orphans, doctors, surgeons, teachers. And many of them are paying back to the foundation. But he found his purpose in life 50 years ago. He didn't know where it would go. But he's a saint. If you see him, you'll see the bliss in his eyes. He's like the happiest guy on this planet.
I sometimes think that it's the one of the reasons why people don't spend enough time thinking about this issue is because we're so busy with so many other things that there's very little time, or people set aside very little time to think about what is the purpose.
Yeah, they do. Plus, we look for happiness in the wrong places. So we think that if we win the lottery or we get a luxury car, move into a huge mansion, we'll be happy. And all the research has shown that if you move into a huge mansion or you buy a luxury car, after 3 or 6 months, you're back to your baseline. You know, it's a car, it's a wonderful mansion, but you're basically sleeping, maybe entertaining friends. And this phenomenon is called hedonic adaptation. In contrast, meaningful experiences and partaking in charities. You know, I was asked to give a talk on philanthropy, a short talk. I said, philanthropy is love for humanity. Very simple definition. And there are three aspects to philanthropy. Most of us think, oh, we have to write a check or go to a fundraiser, bid in an auction. That's one of them. That's treasure. The other is time. The third is talent. If you give any of these three Ts, you are philanthropic. Saint Francis of Assisi once said, "For it is in the giving that we receive." One of his fav my favorite quotes of him is, he said, "Preach the gospel at all times. If necessary, use words." How good is that? Lead by example. There's a story of Gandhiji sitting in his ashram, and this mother walks 8 miles in the dust and the heat with her 12-year-old son. She says, "Gandhiji, look at my son. He's gained a lot of weight. He's eating a lot of sugar. Would you please tell him not to eat sugar? He adores you. He worships you. He'll do anything for you." Gandhi looks at the boy and the mother. He says, "Come back in a week." So they go away. A week later, again, they walk 8 miles in the dust and heat. Gandhi looks at the boy. He says, "Son, don't eat sugar. It's not good for your health." And the boy says, "Gandhiji, from this moment onwards, I have given up sugar." And he leaves the room. And the mother stays behind and she says, "Gandhiji, thank you for saying that to my son. Can I ask you a question?" He says, "Sure. We were here a week ago.
Why did
You
you
could have
say
said listening to my son then." And
Yes.
Gandhi whispers into her ear, "At that time, I had not given up sugar."
Oh, wow, that is
Right?
incredible.
Do
That's
as I
amazing.
do, not do as I say.
Okay, let's take a little bit of a slight tangent. I know that you're the editor of the Hepatology Up to Date, so I guess you're always getting the latest in medicine, and you also have thought about looked at what is the emerging technologies and breakthroughs. So I wanted you just to maybe just talk about that for our sort of viewers can get your
Yeah,
thoughts on
so
it.
when I became a hepatologist, there was very little in the way of treatment for liver disease. And back 60, 70 years ago, if somebody had jaundice, you gave them steroids. And if they got better, you said, "Aha, medical jaundice." And if they didn't get better, you said, "Oh, surgical jaundice," and you operated on them. And now we have treatments for so many of the chronic liver disorders. Chronic hepatitis C, which afflicts 170 million people, we have a cure. It's the only chronic viral infection in human beings where we can use the radical term cure. And now we're using pills for 8 weeks or 12 weeks. And it has a 90 to 100% cure rate, no trace of the virus in the blood or in the liver 20 years later with pills. Pretty remarkable. The initial treatment, interferon monotherapy, 6 months, had a 6% cure rate. And this 90 to 100% cure rate is even if they have cirrhosis, even if they have co-infection with HIV. I have a patient I cured with HIV, cirrhosis, and schizophrenia. A very devoted mother, so she made sure he took all his medicines. Cured. So that's an amazing study. Chronic hepatitis B afflicts about 350 million people. We don't have a cure, but we can suppress it using antiviral agents. And if we have undetected HBV DNA, they do better. They're less likely to get a transplant, less likely to develop primary liver cancer. So those two viruses afflict more than half a billion people in the world. But the dominant chronic liver disease now in the world, which is a sad commentary about our lifestyle, is non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which now is being called metabolic associated steatotic liver disease. 1.5 billion people in the world. There are 3-year-olds in America who have fatty liver, 16-year-olds with fibrosis. There are 25-year-olds getting a liver transplant. And then the other dominant liver disease worldwide is alcoholic cirrhosis, too much excess alcohol. Now, what we've learned in recent years, a couple of very interesting things. Number one, the strongest determinant of alcoholism is having a biological parent who is an alcoholic. And this we've learned from national adoption registries in Denmark. The other interesting thing about alcoholic cirrhosis is that coffee is amazingly hepatoprotective.
Oh,
We
wow.
have to drink, one has to drink a pint of whiskey a day or a liter of wine a day for 20 years in a row. And then 20, 25% becomes cirrhotic. And we used to say, What happened to the others? Oh, maybe good genes, maybe the way they metabolize alcohol because of alcohol dehydrogenase. The answer is coffee. If you drink that much and drink one cup of regular coffee a day, 20% reduction in alcoholic cirrhosis, two cups, 40%, three cups, 60%, four cups, 80%, five cups, you won't get it. Now, it's not a
Wow.
license to drink heavily and drink coffee. Yes, it'll protect your liver, but you can get, as you know, Korsakoff psychosis, cardiomyopathy, pancreatitis, kill people on the road, lose your job, lose your family. So,
Is
not a license.
it helping with the fatty liver, or you're saying
Fatty
the
liver too.
cirrhosis?
It's both. So, fatty liver, if you look at non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, the number one factor that is responsible for the least amount of fibrosis or scarring of the liver is drinking coffee. Coffee also lowers the risk of seven cancers, common cancers: head and neck cancer, breast cancer, uterine cancer, colon cancer, skin cancer, prostate cancer, liver cancer. Low risk of Alzheimer's, cognitive decline, Parkinsonism, gout, dental cavities, death by suicide. Good for bone health. Low risk of kidney stones, gallstones. So the holy grail would be, if it has all these benefits, do people who drink coffee live longer? And now there are five studies: New England Journal of Medicine, Annals of Internal Medicine, JAMA, Lancet. Men and women who drink coffee have lower total and cause-specific mortality. So here's my take on it. I think you'll agree. Inflammation is the enemy, whether it's COVID, arthritis, obesity, cancer, liver disease, doesn't matter. Coffee drinkers have the lowest levels of CRP,
Got it.
C-reactive protein, inflammatory
Right.
marker, lowest levels of TNF alpha.
Yeah.
They have, it's insulin sensitizing, so it protects against type 2 diabetes. And even decaf, it's not the caffeine. Coffee has 1,000 constituents. So even decaf coffee, because I talk about it and I've written a book called Coffee, the Magical Elixir, my colleagues around the country will send me an email. Sanjeev, you've probably seen, but in case you missed this. So the chief of hematology oncology at Beth Israel Deaconess, Harvard Medical School, dear friend, Lord Schnipper, he sent me an article about a year ago, people published in JAMA Oncology, patients with stage four colon cancer. Colon cancer, mets to the liver, peritoneum, lymph nodes, who drink coffee, including decaf coffee, have improved disease-free survival and dose-dependent. Four cups better than three, three better than two, two better than one. So I recommend 2 to 4 cups. If you can drink regular coffee. I was interviewed by ABC about this. And at the end of the interview, this Emmy Award-winning lady, Nicole Estefan, she said, Sanjeev, final question. What's the best way to drink coffee? I said, Nicole, the best way to drink coffee is to drink coffee with a friend. And that went viral. Then I said, now I'll give you the scientific answer. If you don't have diabetes, you can add sugar or milk or cream. I drink it black. The worst thing we can do is add artificial sweeteners. Never drink a Diet Coke. Three times the risk of stroke, heart attack. Now there's going to be an FDA warning that it may be carcinogenic. So get rid of that Diet Coke. If you're really in the mood, have a regular Coke. Have a little bit. Best drink in the world is water. Next best is coffee.
Wow,
So
that's very
the other
interesting,
thing the other fascinating thing, Sanjeev, is the gut microbiome, the 100 trillion bacteria in our gut. It's been called the second human genome, the inner bacterial rainforest. In aggregate, they weigh 3 pounds. Implications, including response to chemotherapy, side effects of chemotherapy, autism. There's a psychiatrist in Ireland who's coined the term and written a book with two colleagues called Psychobiome. All the studies are small. 18 people with autism were given a fecal microbiota transplant, healthy stool, and 2.5 years later, their microbiota have remained altered, marked improvement in GI, psychological, neurological symptoms. So we need to study it. There's a study, and it's been published, alcohol use disorder. Give them healthy stool transplant. It changes their craving for alcohol. Unbelievable. So big story. I actually give a keynote around the country. I'm going to give it in Singapore in May. Microbiome, Man and Medicine, one of the hottest topics in medicine. And I have to update this talk every 2 weeks. There's something new.
That's amazing. That's incredible. And I guess I just want to just, what is your thoughts on what is a safe amount of alcohol one can drink?
So,
What is
if my patients, when they would ask me that question, I would say to them, because they had liver disease, right? I would say to them, we have two eyes, two lungs, two kidneys. And before I can complete the sentence, they would say, yes, Dr. Chopra, one liver. I said, you cannot afford to even look at it. Now there's non-alcoholic beer, and there's some non-alcoholic beers that are absolutely delicious. And they're capturing a lot of the market. So if you are in a social setting, everyone's drinking alcohol and you're feeling odd, drink a non-alcoholic beer. And if you have a family history of alcoholism, mother or father, then you shouldn't be drinking at all. No alcohol. We need to have this message given in elementary school and middle school,
Right.
young people.
Yeah, I mean, we grew up kind of with the, and I think it's maybe changing recently, but this idea that, one or two drinks a day was actually healthy and people lived a long time, and the blue zones, maybe some of the blue zone people are using drinking regular amounts of alcohol, but I think maybe the part about them, their social community was probably a stronger
Yeah,
aspect,
true.
maybe confounded those results.
But if there's no history of family history, if you don't have any medical problems related to alcohol, some of the studies show, I have a colleague, Ken Mukamal, professor of medicine, primary care doctor. He's done a lot of research, published extensively, given grand rounds. And he says two drinks a day for men and one drink a day for women. And he said regularity and is healthy. Regularity and periodicity is important. So every day, so a man can have, with no other problems, can have 14 drinks in a week, but two a day. Not drinking on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, then drinking five on Friday evening, four on Saturday, and four on Sunday. That's not good. Regularity, periodicity is very important. And for women, not to exceed one. If they drink more than one, the alcohol gets converted to estrogen, and there's a 30% increase in estrogen positive, receptor positive breast cancer. So small increase, but not trivial.
I mean, alcohol's also been linked to certain increase in cancers as well, isn't it? Has it not?
Especially esophageal, liver.
Yeah. Interesting. So what is the what is your like, what is your these days you're working on the book, Letters to a Young Doctor. So just tell us a little bit more about that. Is it that yeah, I would love to hear more about this. What is going to happen with this
You know,
book?
in that book, we talk about how, as physicians, you can carve out a paddle or an alternate career. Then we tell stories about so many amazing physicians, including my brother, Deepak Chopra, who has written 95 books, 25 New York Times bestseller. We wrote a book together called Brotherhood, Dharma, Destiny, and the American Dream, national bestseller. Then we talk about Abraham Verghese, who is at Stanford. He used to be at Boston City Hospital. He actually reminded me recently that he came to my home and played tennis with me. Then he went to Mississippi. He wrote a book called Cutting for Stone. And it was in the New York, it's the story is about a surgeon by the name of Stone. And it was 630 pages. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for 26 months. He couldn't put the book down. So I met him recently. He and I were both giving keynotes at the same conference, and he came to the breakfast lounge, the faculty lounge, and talk about humility. He said, can I have a selfie with you so I can tell my friends I know Sanjeev Chopra? I said, Abraham, you're world famous. You're so famous. What is the next book you're writing? And is it going to be 630 pages like Cutting for Stone? He said, Sanjeev, it's going to be called A Covenant of Water. It's about three generations in Kerala that have a curse. I said, so how long? He said, right now it's 710 pages.
Oh,
It
wow.
came out 6, 8 months ago, 735 pages. It's hit the publishing world by storm. Oprah Winfrey is walking on beaches with heavy bags and doling out free copies of the book. She recently said, "I started reading at age three. This is one of the best three books I've ever read." So we tell the stories of Somerset Maugham, Arthur Conan Doyle, different physicians who became authors, writers, speaker, Paul Farmer, public health. So I think it is to inspire young people going into the medical profession that if I become a rheumatologist, I can still have another career parallel. Or when I retire and become an author and a speaker, like so many of these people have done. So actually, this was the idea of my literary agent, Amanda Annis, Trident Media in New York. They had helped me publish a number of my books. And she said, "Sanjeev, you've carved out a interesting parallel career in speaking and writing. Why don't you write a book?" And then she came up with the title, which I loved, Letters to a
Right.
Young.
That's so interesting. So what is your, so are you saying that your advice to young doctors and young healthcare providers is to consider also having other interests apart from actual clinical medicine?
Yes, absolutely. When I'm a visiting professor, Sanjeev, I'll give you an example. University of Washington, Seattle, Dr. Carithers, Bob Carithers, and his wife, Janita, dear friends, eminent hepatologist, he retired. And when he retired, he endowed a visiting professorship, and I was honored to be the inaugural visiting professor. So I meet eight hepatologists, and I ask every time I'm a visiting professor, and especially junior faculty, I'll ask the question. And I sort of know the answer. Have you given a TEDx talk? No. Have you written a book? No. Are you passionate about something? Yes. I said, "You have a book in you." I come back 10 months later, two of them have written a book. Sanjeev, you planted the seed. One of them is from Cyprus, and he went to Oxford on a fellowship and a scholarship. And now he's at the Seattle VA. And he wrote a book about lessons he's learned from his patients. 18 chapters.
Oh,
I
wow.
couldn't put it down. About anger, about frustration, about jealousy, about grief, about cancer. Amazing book. So everyone has a book. People say, "But I don't know how to write." I said, "Just jot down your thoughts, dictate them into your iPhone. And don't worry about the grammar. Don't worry about the sequence. You can also get a professional writer to help you with the editing and doing research for you, making sure the quotes are accurate. And then you can get a publisher. And if you don't, and I'll help you. And I can't promise you, but if you can't get a publisher, you can self-publish for like $3,000. And it's a legacy you leave behind for your children and your grandchildren. It's an amazing journey."
I think our viewers would love to hear how do you stay on top of your mission and your purpose, like every day to day, like how do you live your life to like keep
I
it
think
going?
the key thing I do is I happen to have about 25 amazing friends in five continents, and some of them I talk to every 2 or 3 days. The ones in Boston, I may even meet twice a week for coffee. I had breakfast with a dear friend this morning. He turned 80. So I said, "I'm going to treat you to breakfast." So some I speak to with once a month, once in 6 weeks. So I stay in touch with them. And every single friend of mine inspires me. So that's number one. Number two, in order to be grounded and to be anchored, because like you mentioned earlier, there's so much chaos and noise and social media, we have to experience silence. So I wrote a book called The Big Five, Five Things We Can Do Based on Scientific Evidence to Live Long. Coffee, exercise, vitamin D3, nuts, meditation. And when I wrote that book, I did about 20 interviews, radio, TV, some were 5 minutes, some were 20 minutes. I told the moderator, "Give me 15 seconds at the end to summarize," even though there are only five things. And they all did that. I said, "Here's the deal. On a good sunny day, go for a brisk walk to your favorite Java shop. Now you got the vitamin D from the sun, the exercise, and the coffee. Three out of the five. Number four, don't go nuts remembering this." So that's us. And number five, before you go, meditate. And there's
Right.
an ancient saying you should meditate once a day. And if you don't have time to do that, you should meditate twice a day. And all remembered it. They'd meet me 6 months later. Sanjay, five things. So you got to make it fun. You got to make it easy to remember. But I
That's great.
think spending quality time with your friends, with your family, making sure you have enough vacations, even if you do a 3 or 4 day vacation, it so rejuvenates you. And then meditating. And then if you can partake in some philanthropy, that is so much fun to do. They're simple things. They're low tech things.
Wow. Okay, that's amazing. So apart from the book that's coming up, what's on your mind? What else do you want to
So, you know,
accomplish?
one of the things I keep doing is I keep developing new talks. So I developed a new talk which I've given as grand rounds at Harvard Med School and elsewhere. And it's called Lifelong Learning, a look through the rearview mirror and a peek ahead. And in the rearview mirror, I talk about four conditions. And of course, I'm biased, hepatology, GI. So I talk about celiac disease. I talk about hepatitis C, which was called non-A, non-B hepatitis, H. pylori, and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. I looked up a textbook of medicine from 25 years ago. There's no mention of any of these four topics. Can you believe it? Not a word. There's one mention in the section in dermatology of a textbook of medicine. There's one sentence: patients with underlying dermatitis herpetiformis may have underlying celiac disease. One sentence. And we used to think it's a rare disorder, but now the studies show that it's present in about 1% of people all over the world, including India. And we have a celiac center at our hospital. We have the only celiac fellowship, perhaps, in the world. And we teach our interns and residents and medical students, everyone has celiac disease unless proven otherwise.
Oh, wow.
All right, think about it. Whether you have CNS manifestations, dental anomalies, infertility, anxiety, depression, liver disease, iron deficiency anemia, hypospadenism, on and on, slide of 60 different things. So that is amazing that it wasn't even mentioned. H. pylori, Barry Marshall, and Ern Warren got the Nobel Prize. You know, hepatitis C, we have, as I mentioned earlier, a curate. So amazing stuff. And NAFLD, the dominant chronic liver disease. Then in the peek ahead, I start with a quote by Niels Bohr, who was a physicist, Nobel laureate, and about 100 years ago, he said, predictions are difficult, particularly those about the future.
Exactly.
It sounds like Yogi Berra would have said it. But anyway, Niels Bohr said it. I said, now I'm going to be courageous and predict which are the five, amongst the five biggest stories in medicine, biological sciences playing out. And they include artificial intelligence. Perhaps a better term would be aided or augmented intelligence. Look at this. There's a study where Mayo Clinic published, they looked at 5,210 patients coming to a liver transplant, 27,500 matched controls. Somebody decided to look at their EKG and incorporate AI, and it comes up with a score and it predicts severity of liver disease. You need a liver transplant. After the liver transplant, it reverts to normal. We have no idea how it does it. The most brilliant cardiologist would be clueless.
Would never.
Another study looking at chest PAs, incorporate AI, it says this person, that person has type 2 diabetes. It's going to change the way we practice medicine. The doctor of the future who does not incorporate AI will be obsolete. The doctor of the future who incorporates AI will be a smarter doctor. Smart medicine. So AI, microbiome, we talked about it, CRISPR and gene editing. We are now, you know, Jennifer Doudna was 12 years of age. She comes back from school. She had two younger siblings, both sisters. Her father doted on her, and he puts a book on her bed, The Double Helix by James Watson. He was 24 when he published that paper with Crick and Wilkinson, then became a Nobel laureate. She reads it. She's so enthralled. The next day, she goes to the chemistry teacher and she says, I want to learn chemistry. And this is America. And he says, young lady, chemistry is not for girls, it's for boys.
Right.
Last year, she got the Nobel Prize in chemistry together with Emmanuel Charpentier from Paris. Gene editing already proven to cure sickle cell anemia,
Right.
hemophilia, some forms of hereditary deafness, angioedema. And now it's expensive. The cure for sickle cell is like 2.2 million, but they no longer require hospitalizations, no bone crisis, liver, pulmonary crisis, no transfusions needed. It's a huge story. Then
Yeah.
messenger RNA, which is the basis of the COVID vaccine, where Drew Perlman and Caitlin Caracco from Perlman School of Medicine at UPenn got the Nobel Prize last year. And then, believe it or not, the fifth one is the psychedelic revolution with magic mushrooms, ketamine, LSD. And now it's being studied. See, previously in the 70s, Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert at Harvard were doling out LSD to students, and they were thrown out of Harvard. And now it's not just a subjective experience. We can study in the blood the happy molecules, oxytocin, endorphins, dopamine, and we can do functional MRI. And in functional MRI, you can see neuronal connections growing, the concept of neuroplasticity. The old saying, we can't teach an old dog new tricks, is no longer valid. We can teach old dogs lots of new tricks. And
Wow.
here's the tragic comment. Number one cause of death in people in the world between 20 and 35 is death by suicide. What? And we give horrible antidepressants. They don't work, have side effects. Exercise helps if people can do it. And then if it doesn't work, we do electroconvulsive shock therapy. But you give them four or five treatments with ketamine spaced over a couple of weeks, and it changes their life. I know of a person who was very depressed. He was a very good hockey player. He took five IV ketamine treatments, changed the way he viewed the world. He told his fiancée, I've hired this skating rink tomorrow between 4 and 6. You want to come with me with the video camera and record me? So he skates, records, gives it to talent scouts. He's
Right.
playing for the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Oh.
Professional hockey, guy on the verge of killing it. It's not one story. There are many, many stories like this. So these, I think, five, I think stem cells and regenerative medicine. We're not there yet, but we'll be able to cure type 1 diabetes. We'll be able to cure people with paraplegia from spinal cord injury. People with bad knee arthritis. I'm heading for a right total knee.
Okay. Yeah. So it sounds like you're so hopeful. I mean, it's so inspiring to hear you. You sound very hopeful about the future.
I am. Winston Churchill, whom I talk about in my leadership talk, he was a racist and
Yeah.
he despised Gandhi and he was responsible for 4 million Bengalis dying in a famine in
Right.
Calcutta. Because he said, divert the ships docking there with rice to Greece and other islands. But he once said, he was a brilliant orator, and he once said, a pessimist sees difficulty in every opportunity. An optimist sees opportunity in every difficulty. So by nature, I'm an optimist. Sometimes my friends say, you're too optimistic. I said, I'm sorry. By nature, like, take it or leave it.
Final kind of question. I'm just so curious about your wisdom about aging and like how do you dealing and of course everyone's dealing with loss and how the body's changing and the mind is changing, just with age and how do you
I think one of the
deal with
interesting
those
things is
issues?
that we can study the phenomenon to some extent, right? There's a frailty index that is sometimes used in ICUs for sick patients, but we can also measure telomerase
Yeah.
in the blood and telomere length. And here's the fascinating thing about telomeres. So Elizabeth Blackburn, brilliant Australian scientist, together with two colleagues, got the Nobel Prize in Medicine or Physiology in 2009
Yep.
for their work on
Telomeres.
telomeres. So, who has shortened telomeres and by inference accelerated cellular aging? Mothers of chronically severely disabled children. They're stressed day in, day out, taking care of your loved child, unless they meditate or they have good support. Who else? Caregivers of people with Alzheimer's. The person with Alzheimer's is clueless. The loved one taking care of them is dying multiple times during the day. There's a story of Ronald Reagan. He's left the White House. He's got Alzheimer's. Somebody had gifted him a replica of the White House, and he's looking at it. He says, "Nancy, Nancy, what is this? I think it has some meaning in my life. What is it?" He just says it innocently. She's crying, right? And who has longer telomeres? People who on the Mediterranean diet, people who exercise, people who meditate, and people who drink coffee.
Yeah.
Perhaps people on metformin.
Yeah.
I have friends, professors of medicine at Harvard, who do not have diabetes. They take metformin.
Yeah.
So I think we can do a few things to live longer. The social connectedness fabric with friends, very important. Very, very important. Exercise, very important. Vitamin D, nuts, meditation. So there are some things we can do. And then to mitigate against Alzheimer's, there are very few things we can do. But one of them is physical exercise. And the other, it, again, happens to be coffee. And the third one is learning something new. If I play chess every day, I may get better at chess, but it doesn't mitigate the risk of Alzheimer's. What I need to do is learn something new, new language, ballroom dancing, do something that I haven't done before. We had a speaker, and he mentioned, he said, even micro exercise may mitigate. So I said, what is micro exercise? And he hasn't published this, so we can't reference it. But he said, doodling, take a piece of paper and just doodle, micro exercise. It works. What? And this is a very famous guy, Siddhartha Mukherjee, who wrote his first book as a fellow at Harvard Medical School, Dana-Farber Mass General, The Emperor's Malady, A Biography of Cancer. First book, he gets a Pulitzer Prize. Now he's in New York. Brilliant guy.
Yeah. Okay, that's. I think this is perfect end off here. I really appreciate your time, Dr. Chopra. This is great. What would where can people learn more about you and get the book, and where would they find that?
I do have a website. It's called Sanjeev Chopra, one word, SANJIVCHOPRA.com. And some of my talks are there, and a lot of the books I've written are there. So some information.
Perfect. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. All the best. I hope to meet you sometime in Canada, Boston.
Yes, for sure. Invite's always open.
Yeah. All the best.
Thank you.
Bye.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed today's talk with Dr. Sanjeev Chopra. I felt it was really inspiring, and I hope you did too. I really got out the parts about the importance of family, friends, service, and gratitude. He also talked about the importance of developing a purpose and its relation to happiness. I was really surprised about the impact of coffee. I wasn't aware that it had so many health benefits, so I hope you got something out of it just like I did. And if you like today's video, make sure you subscribe and share it with your friends, and that will make a great impact on getting the word out. We'll talk to you later.